the Denisons, the Denisons, the busiest in the biz. You do know who it is, it's Dennis Quaid. That's him.
Being an actor, I get to play make-believe and become other people, both real and fictional. One of my career highlights was playing Jimmy Morris in The Rookie. Today on The Denisons, Jimmy's my guest, and we chat about life and his amazing journey from coaching high school baseball to the major leagues. Thanks for listening. Hey, this is The Denisons, and I am talking today to Jimmy Morris, the real rookie. He's out there in Texas. I'm here in Los Angeles. Due to the coronavirus, we're not able to be in the same room, so we're social distancing. Jimmy, how are you doing?
Fantastic, Dennis. It's just, I guess we're starting to look at a new normal. We don't even know what it's going to be yet.
Right. A lot of things are going to change by the time we get back there. Just don't know what that's going to be yet. So there's a lot of uncertainty, I think, for everybody. It's kind of tested our constitution a bit, I think, and our relations with a lot of the rest of the world. But we're going to get through it. We're Americans. And I think something wonderful is going to come out of it myself. I think there just might be a spiritual awakening in this country.
I'm hoping so.
What do you think?
I definitely hope so, because, you know, this is not a me or a you thing. It's a we thing. And we're in this together, and we're going to have to find a solution together, and we're going to be going into tomorrow together. And so let's just get along and maybe look up instead of looking down.
Yeah, I think it's forced people to really kind of look inward, and adversity has a way of bringing out people who they really are and what's going on with them at that time. So I know Laura and I, we were going to get married April 4th in Hawaii. And this has turned out we're together with my kids during the quarantine. And it's great premarital therapy, that's for sure. Definitely really know I'd like to be in a foxhole with her if it came to that. She'd be good for it. You know, all those issues that were bubbling underneath the surface as people have come to the forefront. It's sort of like our 40 days in the desert.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest things is everybody's going, I want to get back to normal. I want to get back to normal. Well, for a lot of people, was normal really any good to begin with? Because we complained about it all the time.
Yeah.
And if you're busy looking back at normal, you're not looking at the blessings that are lined up in front of you. And I think that's where we got to go. We got to go ahead.
Yeah. Everybody wants change, but we all are kicking and screaming, getting dragged into it. So here we go. But, Jimmy is one of those real life people, characters that I have played in film, along with Doc Holliday and Gordo Cooper. And I remember I got the call about The Rookie, which back in 2000, I think, was when Disney was making the movie. Just reading the script, it really made me... It choked me up. I mean, it was welled me up, and it was love the movie. Just love the movie, and it's as far as it's a fan favorite as well. It's how many kids and fathers and come up to me about The Rookie and how it inspired them. How they just watched it yesterday, or their kids watched it 40 times. And what it did for me, it did a lot for me in my life, The Rookie. Your story inspired me, and it was about second chances. That's what it was about. It wasn't about baseball. It's a great baseball movie, but that's what made it a great movie, because it was about second chances in life. And who can't relate to that or want a second chance at something? Or if I could just go back and redo that again, I would do it differently. And America loves a comeback story like that. And you just epitomized it. You were on the set, too, quite a bit during the making of it. So just tell me, how did it come about that somebody got interested in making a film about your life?
Man, that's a loaded question right there. I'm in AAA, and I just signed Steve Kanner, my agent, and people started calling. One of them was Mark Chiardi, who was getting into the movie industry and had quit baseball to go model and then came back and got to Hollywood. And he's working out with Eisner at Disney at the time. And they saw these interviews I was doing while they were working out. And Mark goes, I know that guy. And I guess the guy goes, hey, get a hold of him. And so Mark started calling me, goes, hey, we want to make a movie about you. And I go, yeah, ha, ha, ha. And I hung up. And he kept calling back. And I'm like, dude, I'm 35 years old. I'm not going to start the world on fire. I weigh 250 pounds. This is not going to be a comedy. I don't want a comedy. And he kept calling. And finally, I told Steve, I said, Steve, make the phone call stop. And then through all this stuff, Bill Plaschke for the LA Times writes an article on me in a Sunday edition, covers the whole front page of the sports page. And so the second day I'm in the big leagues, this paper comes out. In LA, we're in Anaheim to play the Angels for 4 games. Mm. They had to change my name in the hotel that night because everybody was calling about documentaries and books and articles and movies. And so for the next 4 days, we drove around Hollywood before game time, visiting with all the studios. And Disney is where we settled, because as we're walking across, they're the last studio we saw. And as we're walking across their grounds, Steve looks at me, he goes, what do you want? And I said, I want a movie about kids who were counted out, but they got to come back and do something really great that nobody thought they could, not even themselves. And I said, on the other side of that, I want everybody to know that even as an adult, we have second chances. Are you willing to go out and take a chance on that second chance? Are you going to let it ride? And we get up into Eisner's office and he goes, now what I have in mind, he repeated everything I'd said walking across the grounds. And I thought, they have microphones everywhere. We were sold before we ever left the studio. I thought, you know what? This is where I want to be. They want to keep it as true to form as possible. And that's what I
want. Were you getting different stories from different studios about their take on what they thought was interesting? Or
oh, man, it was amazing and horrible at the same time, because everybody's wanting to throw this in and throw that in. Let's throw an affair in. You can have Coach Canseco on your team. Let's throw some of that stuff in and we'll have R-rated movie. I'm like, that's not what this is about. This is actually a movie about kids and second chances. That's what I want.
Yeah.
And Disney was the one that wanted to do that.
Huh. In a way, it was really kind of one of the first sort of mainstream faith films in that sense, related to it. That story, what an incredible, incredible story, man. I'm interested in, from your point of view, because I've never been on a set or watched my life story being made. And I was always really sensitive to that. I played so many real life characters, and all. I didn't want to do like an impression of you, you know, because we don't really look alike or whatever. One thing we did have going was that I was left-handed, which I thought was very important. Like you're left-handed, and to try to get you through from the side. What do they call it? Stance.
Throw out of the stretch, and I'm a southpaw.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and. So I wanted to get all that right, and Jim got to help me with it. But what's it like watching your life story being made?
The first thing out of the box was, after you signed to do the movie, you invited me over to your house in Brentwood to play catch in the front yard. And we're playing catch, and I'm like, I am playing catch with Dennis Quaid. And then I go back and I get in my Jeep when we're done, and I call my mom first. And I go, Mom, guess where I am? And my mom goes, you suck. And I went, I'm in. But on the set, it was so surreal, because every time they're filming something, they're looking at me like, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, I don't know. And then you come over to me when you were talking about the bet, and you're like, what would you say here? And I rattle off a bunch of like 5 minutes worth of stuff. You don't write anything down. And I looked over at Steve. I said, he doesn't even remember it, man. He didn't write anything down. You go back into action and you repeat word for word what I had said. And I was like, oh, yeah, he does this for a living.
Yeah, well, there's a little paraphrasing going on, but I just wanted to capture the essence of you and just get it from you like that. It's got to be an amazing experience. I can only imagine. And Bart Millard was, you know, on the set watching his life. That was a tough one. I can't imagine having to watch that. You know, but he had, as a child, there was a lot of physical abuse and things that he got from his father, and then they overcame. But Gordo Cooper, that was a lot of fun because I was playing an astronaut and getting to do all my boyhood things. But then, you know, baseball and getting to do that again. I hadn't been on a set. I mean, I hadn't been on a baseball diamond since Little League, really, which I was a pitcher and a first baseman. So it was like being a kid again to be out there. Really, really was. But I'd like to, you know, get back to your real story. I mean, you grew up with your dad, who was in the service, right? And he was pretty hard-nosed, very disciplinarian, and tough on you. And you know, baseball was not the priority in your family growing up, was it?
No, it wasn't. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in speeches today is that that relationship was Disney's G-rated version, because I look back, and I think you and I had talked about this a little bit, is like with Bart and you doing I Can Only Imagine, that was basically my childhood. And I verbally and physically abused. He hated me. He's holding my brother one day when my brother's a baby. And my mom walks into the kitchen. He looks at me and he goes, "This is the one we wanted. We never wanted you." And you're like,
wow,
that's not even nice. But you're a little kid and you're like, okay, so you try harder and you try to please him, but it never works because that's not how it is. Now, the difference between Bart Millard and myself is I can't sing, and you know that. And but I just thought it was ironic that you played me in a movie and then years later you played his dad, who was like my dad, in the movie. And I thought, wow, that just comes full circle. And I'm sitting in a theater watching I Can Only Imagine, just bawling, going, wow. That brought up some feelings I didn't know were there anymore. And you did a great job. It was an awesome movie.
Well, do you think that the relationship that you had with your dad really drove you in a way to kind of like, I'll show you? Or do you feel like you had to steal your and hide your dreams?
I mostly hid my dreams. But what I did growing up was I thought, if I can just keep getting myself better. So I never competed against a team. I never competed for his love. I just tried to make me better. And I just went, you know what? He doesn't even matter. I'm just going to go do what I want to do, and I'm going to do it the best I can. And in doing that, it's made me a person who's been able to overcome and persevere through things that other people would have given up on and gone, you know what? That's not even worth it. I'm not doing that. Because there was no use in trying to please someone who wasn't even pleased with himself.
Yeah, doing it for the right reasons and being held back. But you started to get into pro ball at an early age, right? You went... tried out and you got into the minors way back then, or triple A or whatever, right?
It wasn't even triple A back then. In 1982, I was drafted by the Yankees in like the 19th round.
And yeah, 449th pick or something like that. Yeah.
Way down the line, no money, but my grandfather was sick with ALS. And my grandfather is a person who I look up to. He is one of the mentors of my life, and he's one of the dream makers of my life. And I wanted to be there for him and my grandmother because they meant the most to me in my life at that point in time. And so I went to junior college for a semester. And during that semester, I would go home every weekend and see them in the hospital. And unfortunately, the last Sunday in November of 1982, he passed away. And 2 months later, the Brewers drafted me in the first round of the supplemental draft. And that's when they gave me $35,000 to chase my dream. And in my mind at 19, I'm like, I am rich. And for 9 months I was. And it was just, I wasn't ready. I had been moved from Miami, Florida, where I was a baseball star, to Brownwood, Texas, where we didn't even have baseball in high school. So I had to become a football star. And then baseball still something play, but it's a summer league game, 10 games a summer. Uh-huh. You're either playing football, you're getting ready for football, or you're getting ready for football again. And, you know, we are the home in Texas of a $70 million high school football stadium, which I think is ridiculous, but it is a big sport here. But back then, I just wanted to play, but I wasn't prepared for that first spring training. I did not realize that everybody else was way ahead of me. They'd been to college for 3 years, or they'd been playing in the minors. And I get there and I'm terrible. And I don't make any teams. I get hurt in the next 6 years. I get hurt six times, have six surgeries.
On your arm, right?
Yeah, in my arm. Tommy John, shoulder surgery. By the time I'm 24, I'm out of baseball.
Did you know Mark Chardy back then? Speaking of, he was with the Brewers, right?
Yeah, we played together for 3 years. And Mark and I were roommates during spring trainings. And it was fun to be his roommate because he always had this sense of humor and this sarcasm that he just rolled. And but he and I became close, and he's actually the guy who called me in AAA going, I'm working now with Eisner and we want to make a movie about you. And I'm like, you're not making a comedy, dude. Go away. And, but, you know, life comes full circle, and those people who pass through your life at one point may come through in another season. You don't even know when.
It's the truth, man. What's it like, you know, as opposed, you have this big dream of being in the bigs, in the majors, and then to be in the minors, or what is that experience like? Is it a letdown after a kind of, you feel like you get your dream, but then you don't?
Not even so much as getting your dream. It was just, you know what? I did it. I tried it. I had surgery. I failed. Now it's time to go to college and be grown up. And
yeah.
So I never, people ask me all the time, they're like, why did you quit the first time? Well, basically because I couldn't throw. And I went back to college. I got a degree, started teaching and coaching, played college football at 27 and 28. And people go, did you miss it? Could you watch baseball? And man, on my team with the Brewers and the minors, we had like 19 different guys, which is unheard of, go to the big leagues with either the Brewers or different teams. And wow. So I would turn the TV on to watch my friends playing Major League Baseball. For me, that was my fix. And so I was never upset. I was never sad. I went out on my terms. I had surgery. You know, we could fix this and put you back out there. No, I'm good. I'm going to go back to school. And that's what I did.
So you went back to school and you wound up becoming a teacher, correct?
Absolutely.
Getting married, settling down, having a family, making ends meet. And you coached the high school team there.
I did.
The Owls.
The Owls, Reagan County Owls in Big Lake, Texas, which there's no lake there.
Yeah.
I inherited a baseball team that had won one game each year for the 3 years before I got there. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I did as the head coach was I kept that team on the schedule because I'm winning one game. And then I had to talk two more kids into coming out because I only had 8 kids show up. And so the first season we had 10 kids, and I tell people this all the time. I would love to say that I taught those kids everything there is to know about baseball that first season, about wars, recessions, depressions, civil unrest, when the men couldn't play, the women took over and had a league. But these kids weren't even ready for that. We had to learn from the ground up how to put our uniforms on, how to look proper, how to look right. We may not be good, but we're going to look good being bad, basically. Mm-hmm.
Didn't they have any kind of little league ball or around there at all?
They did, but around there, basketball was mainly the big thing.
Yeah.
And so they would get over to baseball and they're like, coach, we don't even know why you took this job. People come through this town on their way to somewhere else. And so you have to change the mentality. And so we learn to take care of ourselves. We learn not to talk to the other team. We learn to be gracious to the people who did show up for us, whether it be umpires who we're not going to talk to because you're never going to win that argument, our parents, the family members that show up, even the teachers and the kids would start coming out. And once that happened, everybody was like, hey, people are coming out and they're watching. That's pretty cool. And that's when you saw a little skip in the step and the chins go up.
But what did you feel like your life was going to be like from then on at that point? You felt like, well, I've chosen my life, right?
Yeah, I prepared for this. I was successful at it. This was the fourth school I'd been at. All my teams had won. All my classrooms had been really successful in the sciences, which I taught. And I love being in a classroom. And so I thought, this is my future. This is what I'm good at. I'm good with this. And that's when those kids threw it back at me.
And that throwing it back at you was you trying out for the bigs again. Tell me that story about how that happened. Because the team wasn't performing, or you were trying to inspire them to perform better. And so tell me that story.
So after we lose the first two games of the year in 1999, somebody in the staff had said something very derogatory towards me about the kids and myself, and two of my kids heard it. And I didn't even know they had heard it because I didn't see them. They were around the corner changing. And basically what was said was, these kids will never amount to anything because they don't know how to win. If it's ever close or they're ever behind, they'll find a way to lose. And then I got a finger put in my chest, which every adult loves. You will never be anything, even though you're a great coach. You're too nice, and nice people don't come out ahead in this life. You need to be able to step on people like me. And I just, wow, and you're in charge. Wow. That's awesome. But those two kids heard it. And before I could get to the field, it spread through my team like wildfire. So those first two games, we get blown out. And basically what I'd done that you can't really depict in a Disney movie is I sent my kids down the left field line. I stood on home plate and I just said a small prayer. And basically it was, what can I do to convince these kids of how good they are? How can I get these kids to dream? How can I push them without breaking them? And eventually what came to me was, go down there and teach them what your grandparents taught you. And so I walked down there, started talking about hopes and dreams and goals. And these are kids who could not even foul the ball off of me at this point in time. And so they're like, what about your dreams? I said, my dream is to watch you guys be successful in the classroom, on the field, graduate, go to college, see what's out there. And then you make up your own mind on where it is you want to be and what it is you want to do. And they're like, but we think you still want to play. And I said, no, I want to stay married. Thank you very much. And they're like, coach, but we know your heart's still in it. You teach us how to act and react to everything. We know what the other team's going to do before they do it. When you throw us batting practice, we can't hit. And I said, that's because you plain can't hit. And they're like, well, why are you telling us to chase our dreams if you're not willing to do it yourself? And I said, you're 18. You need to shut up. And they started giggling. And that's when I got their attention back. And they started smiling and laughing. And they're like, coach, what if we win a district championship, which these kids have never been a part of in baseball? We win a district championship. You try out. And so for 20 minutes, I argued with these kids about every reason to never step back on a professional field. And after 20 minutes, I did what every parent who is going to listen to this does. I caved in. And I said, if you win, I'll find a tryout somewhere. In the back of my mind, I'm going, this is going to be embarrassing and humiliating, which you could do nothing about. But if it gets them to play better, I can embarrass myself and let people laugh at me for a little bit. That's cool. And then over the next 3 months, they start winning, then they start winning a lot. And then I forget about the bet. They're hitting me all over the field. I can't get high school kids out. We win a district championship. I got to go to a tryout. And when I get there, see, I'd thrown 87, 88 the first time around. Mm-hmm. And then now, after having a surgery at the age of 28 and the surgeon going, you'll never, ever pitch again, physically impossible. I cut 85% of the deltoid out of your arm. You can't do it. I go to the tryout and find out I'm throwing 98. I'm not throwing 87. I'm 35, weigh 250 pounds. I'm throwing 98 to 100. And wow. I am stunned because, you know, as a man, you're like,
there's like five people in the world that could do that.
It's amazing because I'm thinking in my mind, any man who they go, you're throwing 98, there's a happy dance going on. But as a teacher, you're going, I have been throwing 98 miles an hour at high school students. I'm getting sued is what I'm getting. And he, I'd say that out loud and the scout laughs. He goes, I got to call in. He goes, I don't care how old you are, but this doesn't happen. You're left-handed. Your ball moves like crazy. You throw 100. I'm calling it in.
Yeah. He'd get fired if he didn't call in a 98-mile-an-hour fastball, just like it said in the movie.
Exactly. And the big thing was with this scout, and Doug Gassaway, he was a great scout. A lot of guys went to big leagues with him, had a drinking problem early in his life. And so when he called a 35-year-old lefty and it threw 98, they thought he was drinking again and hung up on him like three times. And he kept calling back going, no, I'm serious. And so they had me back 2 days later and rained so bad they had to hand me a brand new baseball every pitch, sliding up to my knee in mud with my kids and my high school kids watching, signed a contract back in baseball.
Wow. What a moment in life. Hey, was that first tryout anything like was the movie, like bringing your kids?
Oh, absolutely. I changed diapers. We had a
change diapers in the truck. Between, and you're out there with a bunch of like 19, 20, 21 year olds, right? You're the old man.
Yeah, nobody would play catch with me. They're looking at me like I am out of my mind. And I even thought, I am out of my mind. And, you know, you don't know where that drive is going to come from or where that heart's going to come from. But when you have a group of kids who you're trying to teach something and they're teaching you, you start to listen a little bit closer.
Mm-hmm. It's quite an experience. Your phone started ringing off the wall by the time you got home, right? And you got signed.
Yep.
You got signed to the Devil Rays. And so you went, hey, Dennis Quaid here. You may know that I'm a musician and a huge music fan, and I want to tell you about a new podcast that I discovered. I've been listening to Eric Krasno Plus One, a podcast hosted by Grammy Award-winning guitarist and producer Eric Krasno. I love the interviews. They go deep with musicians, and you hear stories of life in the studio, life on the road. Those are really good, or bad, depending on which side of the story you're on. You got stories with bandmates, and all the other shenanigans that go on behind the scenes. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. Eric's talked to people like Dave Matthews, Marcus King, Chris Robinson, and upcoming episodes feature conversations with John Mayer, Questlove, Derek Trucks, Phil Lesh, and so many more. So take a listen to Eric Krasno Plus One. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you get your podcast. Hi, Dennis Quaid here. Hey, we all have tough days and things that interfere with our happiness or achieving our goals. If you are looking to better yourself, then you should look into BetterHelp. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. BetterHelp evaluates what you need and connects you to your very own licensed professional therapist. You'll be connected in less than one day, and you can send messages to your counselor anytime, day or night. This is not self-help, but it is professional counseling from the comfort of your own home. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you could schedule your own weekly video or phone sessions. Confidential, convenient, professional, and affordable. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/Quaid. Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/Quaid. You went to the minors, and so you basically had to take a pay cut to go play ball, right? And also leave your wife and the kids at home. And we're talking about on the road for, 5 months of the year?
Something that was so far past normal to me because I hadn't done it in so long. And now you're riding a bus. And you're riding a bus in the back. You're not up there with the coaches being the coach. You're a player. And so these kids are asking you questions. I'm in AA, and people all the time, they go, what was it like playing with the kids who are barely older than the kids you were coaching? It was in AA that I found out. Because the first night, I do pretty good, 91, 92 miles an hour, strike out a guy, get a double play ball. The second night, two innings, strike out five guys, throw 98 and 99. And that's when the questions started, and that's when I realized the difference in maturity between 19 and 35. Kid sitting next to me goes, you married? And I said, for now. And so the kid behind him goes, you got kids? I said, I got three. Told them their names and their ages. Now the kid sitting behind that kid is looking at me completely perplexed. He's trying to formulate a question. And what comes out of his mouth stuns me. He goes, so after each kid, do you start throwing harder? And I'm like, well, yes, I did. And I'm going to have a couple more. Wait till then.
So how long were you in the minors before you got called up? It was a season or two seasons?
I was in, 3 months. I was in AA for 3 days and then in AAA for 2 months.
Right. So so they took advantage of you real quick because of your speed. And was it like that scene in the movie where you got called up? In the movie, it was like you felt like you were going to get cut. It was just that things weren't working out. It was very tough. So in the movie, it was when you got called up, it before that had been like very frustrating for you. It was tough on your marriage. It was tough on just being away from your family. You felt like you didn't know what you were doing there, that it was just kind of a pipe dream, that you weren't good enough and then you weren't going to make it. And especially with these kids that you were playing with, some were really great and they were going to go before you. So was it a surprise that when you got called up?
It was an amazing time because, people talk to me about my faith all the time. And there were certain instances where I'm like, God, if you want me to do this, you've really got to lay it out there for me, because I've got this job waiting for me in Fort Worth at this great big high school, and the opportunity to work with more kids in a bigger environment. That's what I'm successful at. I'm good at that. I've never failed at that. If you want me to do this, you got to show me something. And so during that period of time, like Sports Illustrated came in and they took pictures of me, and Louisville Slugger had come by, and one of my teammates had talked them into giving me a glove. And so I've got that glove on when the Sports Illustrated guy takes my picture. I end up in the magazine. Louisville Slugger is like this across my glove. And they're like, hey, we're going to give you a contract. Money goes home. I get gloves. I stay a little bit longer. You know, a month later, shoe contract. I got shoes on. And money goes home. I get shoes. I stay a little bit longer. And then I'm just like, I guess you want me to stay here. And so I stick it out. And before I know it, we're playing the AAA playoffs. If we win this game, we go to the AAA World Series. And it's 2-1 when I come in. It's 2-1 when my best friend Bobby Munoz came out. We've lost. Season's over. We're going home. We're going to ride home together because he lives in Dallas. He's got a pickup. All our bags are in there. And as I'm standing there, our manager, Phil Evers, comes in. And he taps me on the shoulder. He goes, I need to talk to you. And I look around the locker room. I look back at him. I said, I don't think so. And he said, why? I said, because the last seven guys you talked to are all crying right now. And I choose not to cry. And he laughed at me. And he said, come on. And I walk into his office. And I don't even realize this at the time. But our big league general manager, Chuck Lamar, is there. And he goes, you can smile. You're going to be in Texas tomorrow. And I didn't get it. And I said, I know that. Bobby and I are going there right now. And he goes, no, the Rays are in Texas playing the Rangers, and there's a uniform waiting on you. If somebody had a picture of my face at that time, it would be the most stunned look ever, because I was just like, I go call on my high school kids. I call my kids. And the next day, the ballpark in Arlington, I walk into a clubhouse where there's Wade Boggs, who had just gotten his 3000th hit, automatic Hall of Famer. He walks up, he hugs me. He goes, I've heard about you for 3 months now, the crazy science teacher. He goes, that is the best story I've ever heard. And I'm still a coach and a fan. I'm looking at him. I'm like, you're Wade Boggs. And he laughs at me and he walks off. Roberto Hernandez, Fred McGriff, Jose Canseco. And they accepted me because I could do what I was there to do. But I have to sign a contract before I can walk into the locker room. And when I signed that contract, they gave me 10 days meal money. And that meal money was more than 2 months of teaching salary. And I thought, I could get used to this real quick.
Yeah.
But Johnny Oates, the opposing manager, God rest his soul, let 150 people in the game that day that had ties to me. And so my kids, my high school kids, kids I'd coached against, coaches had gotten school buses and driven 9 hours to the ballpark so they could see the coach who had coached against them, who had made a promise, live it out. So it was your favorite ballpark, your favorite state, and you're living out your dream in front of everybody you know and love.
The chances are less of winning the lottery, really. Incredible. Did you think you were even going to go in that night?
Absolutely not. I'd thrown 3 days in a row in the playoffs, and I thought, there is no way they're having me go in. I get to sit in the bullpen talking to big league pitchers, watching all these 40,000 fans because Texas was in first place. And I thought, I get to sit here and take in my first game with my name and my number on my back with everybody I know and love seeing me in a uniform. And in the eighth inning, they go, get up. And I'm like, they just want me to warm up in front of 40,000 people. That's cool. And 2 minutes later, I'm in. And you running in from the bullpen is pretty much what happened to me. As I'm running in, I open the door and I'm seeing all these colors and I'm hearing all the sounds of baseball and I'm smelling the leather and I'm seeing everything that goes along with that. And I'm like, this has been a lifelong dream. And as I make that run from the bullpen to the mound, as I step my spikes onto the dirt of the mound, I go, I would not change one thing about my journey because that has made me who I am. And this person has been through a lot.
I'm getting kind of choked up just hearing you tell that story again, because it just, for me, it just brings back all those memories, that memory especially of making that run from the bullpen out there in right field to the mound. It was like an experience, I think, like out of body feeling that I think I'll never have again. And I wasn't doing it for real. It was just, you know, I was just making it up. But that must have been something. You know, you've been on so many ballparks, and I'm sure since you were a kid, and then all of a sudden you have all those people in the crowd, and you know, there's your debut. So you got up there, and you were brought in to face that one batter. And what happened?
Royce Clayton was an all-star that year. He's the guy I'm facing. Tom Goodwin's the runner at first, very fast guy for Texas at the time. And when they brought me in, my best friend in the big leagues, Roberto Hernandez, he goes, "When Larry Rothschild handed you the ball, what did he say to you?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "He handed you the ball. He said something. You died laughing. They had you on the big screen in center field talking about what you did for a living. What happened? What did he say?" And I go, "I have no idea what that man said to me. I was petrified." And I take my warm-up pitches. Roy steps in. Strike one, 98. Swings through it. Second pitch, 98 again. He takes it for strike two. Now, the difference between the movie and real life is he fouls off the third pitch over the first base dugout and strikes out on the fourth pitch.
Yeah.
And I just remember John Lee Hancock trying to get the actor to foul off the ball for 8 hours and finally going, "You know what? You struck him out in three pitches." And I'm like,
"All right." Yeah, we didn't really have that much time. It was during the seventh inning stretch that we shot that. In fact, during a real game. So that was something else, man. And your family there and all those kids, what a life-changing experience. And then you stayed on with the team, correct, for the rest of the season, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then you had some more injuries.
Well, I broke camp with the team in 2000 and had like 17 appearances in 20 days. And on the days I wasn't pitching in the game, I was throwing on the side. And even days I was in the game, I was still throwing on the side before the game because they were having me work on different pitches. And I got tired and I didn't know what was up. My neck locked up. I got a sinus infection and it was just weird.
And was it stress, you think?
I had no idea what it was at the time because
those are dealing with a lot of things that you'd never dealt with before and had very little time to train for it.
I had an idea what it was. So I go home and my elbow ended up being stretched out again, my Tommy John surgery. So Dr. Job has Dr. Elitrosh retighten it. I get back in shape. The next year I sign with the Dodgers and I go out to Chavez Ravine where I meet you. And we play catch in the front yard.
So wait a minute. After that first season with the Devil Rays, you were a free agent?
No, after the second season. I'd gotten surgery midway through that season and had to get ready again for the next year.
Right.
And I did so good that Dr. Joe was a doctor for the Dodgers. And he goes, "He's perfect. Sign him." And they signed me. And so I got to tell this story. It's just a short one. I walk into a clubhouse in Vero Beach and there is Sandy Koufax.
Wow.
And he shakes my hand. His fingers go up to my elbow. And I'm like, he has the biggest hands of anybody I've ever seen in my life. And he just smiled at me. He goes, "Hey, lefty." And I'm like, "Sandy Koufax is talking to me. That's pretty cool." But that year, 2001, I go out to LA to work in Dr. Job's office and do weights and stuff. Then I would go out to Dodger Stadium and pitch.
And the movie's coming out here pretty soon too, right?
Well, we're fixing to start filming. So I meet you.
Yeah.
And we meet at Dodger Stadium, Jim Gott's there and you and me. And then all of a sudden we hear this cheering and I'm like, you can't even see anybody. We look up and all these, I guess it was an Asian tour guide bus. There were like 500 Asians up there and they're all smiling and laughing. And when you waved at them, they went bonkers. And I went, "Oh yeah, you're Dennis Quaid." But I'm throwing 95 to 100 there. And literally less than 5 days, I drive from LA, go through Texas to see my kids, then go to Vero Beach. I get to Vero Beach the first day of spring training. I can't throw. I can't judge a ball being thrown back at me. I can't, if a ball's hit at me, I can't tell if it's hit hard, soft, or anything. And then the first week goes by, my neck locks up. I get a sinus infection. I get this horrible headache. And we're not talking about, "Oh, I've got a migraine. I got to lay down." We're talking about 6-7 month headaches. You can't sleep. You can't do anything during the day. You can't take light. And nobody could figure it out. So over the next, I quit, basically. The second week of spring training, and Roberto Hernandez is playing for a different team at that time. We played them the next day. And he goes, you better not leave camp until you talk to me. I'm coming there tomorrow and you better be there. Well, I quit. I packed and I walk into Jim Tracy's office, the Dodgers manager. And I said, you know what? I appreciate the opportunity. You guys have a great organization. Everybody here is so nice and so helpful. I said, but I'm 38 now. I'm not going to set the world on fire. I need to go home and it's time for me to be a dad. And I drive home. My agent's calling me furious. Go back to camp. I said, I'm not doing that. I had not told anybody what was going on. I just told them. And the biggest excuse for me is it's happened so many times. I just went, you know what? My arm hurts. I didn't tell them. I can't see straight. And I'm afraid if somebody hits the ball back at me, I can't judge. It's going to hit me in the mouth or the eyes.
Wow.
And so I go home the next 10 years, 30 different surgeries, all nerve related, different specialists everywhere. They're like, there's nothing wrong. We can't find anything. I go to a specialist in Houston, and he is one of the top specialists in Parkinson's in the world. And he goes, how many concussions have you had? We do this. I'm there for like 8 hours one day. He does all these tests, writing, walking, hopping, skipping. He goes, you have CTE-induced Parkinson's. He goes, you have had too many concussions. And for me, for CTE, all I think is NFL, oh my God, what am I going to do?
Right.
And he goes,
concussion trauma, is that a CTE?
Chronic traumatic encephaly.
Yeah.
It's basically too many head knockings. And I go, well, how do you prove that? And he goes, we can't until you're dead. And I said, well, I'm not there yet. And so he gives me this medicine for Parkinson's and it works. I can smell for the first time in like 5 years. The headache kind of fades. Everything is better. But the medicine tears up my stomach. Eventually, I have a defibrillator put in my chest that goes up to my brain. It's a deep brain stimulator. And it helps me because I couldn't tolerate the medicine. And so everything works perfectly. But over those years, 50 surgeries in 20 years, Dennis.
50 surgeries in 20 years. Surgeries on what? You were just talking about the defibrillator.
Arms, legs, head, chest, stomach, you name it. All the nerves were blown. They were freaking out. They didn't know what was going on. And now I look back going, if they would have figured this out to begin with, I probably could have skipped almost all those surgeries. But during those surgeries over 20 years, you're on opiates the whole time, right?
Right.
And so I'm in pain. It's not helping. I don't know what to do. Well, the painkillers aren't working. I'm not abusing them. I'm just taking them like the doctor said, but that's not working. So I start drinking vodka. And then every time I go to the neurologist, she's like, oh, this is just Parkinson's. It's just going to get worse. It's different. Some people it's fast, some people it's slow, but that's how it is. You know, I've got pills. I add the alcohol. Let's just help. You know what? If I'm not going to live much longer, who cares?
Yeah.
And end up in rehab. And I go down there and it was a Christian rehab in West Palm Beach. And I learn to dry out. And I don't need the painkillers. What I found out about painkillers is when you take painkillers, they increase the pain and then they kill you. And so if you take them for too long, they go to the place where you're hurt and they make it actually hurt worse. I have no idea that worked that way.
Mm.
And then the alcohol was bad. I come home and that is in December of 2016. I do not remember the whole week of Christmas. I OD'd. And so my wife and our kids are there for Christmas. I feel horrible because that's at the time I was angry, but I look back and go, man, what a sorry excuse for a dad. And I go to rehab. I come home. That's the Christmas of 2016. So coming into 2017 and I get home and we start working out every day, Sean and I, and all of a sudden, I'm dragging my leg. And so we go back to the neurologist. They do another brain scan. They're like, nope, Parkinson's is just getting worse. In the meantime, at our church, I've got this, and I don't anybody take this wrong. I got a group of girls praying for me. And when I say girls, they're from 50 to 90, but they want me to call them girls because they don't want to be called ladies. And they start praying for me. And during this period of time, I'm slowly turning down this thing that goes up to my brain, this deep brain stimulator. And I'm not having symptoms. And eventually, and it's in the book, and you wrote the foreword for it. Thank you very much, Dreammakers.
Glad to do it.
Eventually, what happens, I'm sitting in the weight room one day. Should I talk about this?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sitting in my garage, which is my weight room at the time. I've got both doors open. I'm lifting weights. In between sets, I'm sitting down because with Parkinson's, you're kind of tired. And I sit down, and all of a sudden, I hear this voice, and it actually voices, you're healed, you're healed. And I'm like, there's nobody around. I get up, I look outside, my dog's freaking out. He's looking up, he's looking around. I'm like, this is weird. And I think my friends are messing with me, right? They're saying something and then they're running off around the corner. And so I sit back down and I'm trying to contemplate, but the whole time this voice just keeps going, you're healed, you're healed. And then this deep voice, but soothing voice goes, you are healed. I get up, I look around the corner of the garage again, and Dennis, there are feathers all over the ground, everywhere. I go in the house, Shauna comes out, she was taking a nap at the time, and before she comes out, I turn my deep brain stimulator completely off. I close my eyes, I turn in a circle with my eyes closed, which I've not been able to do for 20 years. And she goes, what are you doing? I say, well, I turned my stimulator off and I'm doing circles. She goes, what? Why'd you turn it off? And I said, look, and I did the same thing for her. And she goes, oh my God. I said, you're not going to believe what happened. I tell her the story. We go back outside. Dennis, there's not one feather, not one.
Wow.
And so the book has a feather on it. And there's a very specific reason for that, because there's a faith chapter in there that talks about it. Go back to the neurologist and the neurosurgeon. My neurosurgeon's also a believer, and he goes, I don't have all the answers, man. He goes, if you feel better and you're healed, you're healed. I go to my neurologist, who's in charge of my deep brain.
Nobody gets healed from Parkinson's.
That's what my neurologist said.
Yeah.
And so we go see her, and she has me do all these tests. And she turns her battery checker thing on to see. She goes, you have it off. I said, absolutely, I have it off. And she goes, but your balance is perfect. And I said, yeah. And she has me spin. She goes, what? She goes, I'm sending you back for a brain scan. I go back. I drink this fluid that goes to your brain to show if there's dopamine. Brain scan comes back and goes, you do not have Parkinson's. Your dopamine is perfect.
Wow.
Healed.
Wow.
And she goes, this does not happen. And I went, you know what? It does sometimes.
So the girls praying for you, just that simple act, that's what you attribute it to?
Absolutely. My faith and their faith and their faith in God, having faith in me. Absolutely. There is no way, because all the doctors are going, no, it doesn't happen. And they're going, it happens. He can do anything. I'm telling you, Dennis, I'm healed.
Wow. What do you think the feathers were? Even symbolically. So there were feathers there and then they weren't.
Yeah. There were feathers about this long and they were white and silver.
Well, the first thing I think of is angels.
Absolutely. That's what I think. Here's the deal. And I just forgot about this until now, but it's in the book. There were two nights before this happened. And we had a metal roof at that time because we lived in Kerrville, Texas. And I don't know, we had a metal roof. I hear this clawing at night. And I'm like, Max, what are you doing? My lab. I'm like, what are you clawing on, dude? He is sound asleep. I get up, I walk around, I see nothing.
Max,
I go back to bed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second time that I hear the scratching, he wakes up and he had the fur on his back of his neck is standing straight up. Mm-hmm. And so I grab my gun and he and I go check like the protectors we are. And I don't find anything in the house. So we go outside and there's nothing out there either. But I heard this scratching. And then the third day that happens. And then from that time on, I do not have Parkinson's.
Wow. It was like you were getting worked on during those 3 days.
Absolutely.
I guess. Yeah, something was going on. The story was, as you even yourself told me, because I remember we were, the movie was coming out, The Rookie, and we were doing the press junket for it. And we were at the Four Seasons Hotel there in Beverly Hills. And you were going to start with the Dodgers. That's my memory. And it was the last preseason game. You had thrown a pitch and shredded your arm. And that was the story that was over. But you're saying really what was going on was you had been diagnosed with Parkinson's, right?
What had happened was I hadn't been diagnosed yet because it took us a long time to figure that out. What happened to me was I was afraid that somebody was like Canseco or somebody hitting a line drive back at me pitching was going to hit me in the chest or in the head and I'm done.
Right.
I couldn't judge it. And so I just told him, since I'd had so many surgeries on my arm, I went, you know what? My arm hurts and I can't throw.
How many surgeries did you have on your arm? Like, totally think. Can you even count them?
I probably had 5 on my elbow and 6 on my left shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
But people go, oh, baseball ruined you. No, I've had 7 on my right shoulder, and that was from high school and college football. I've had 30 concussions, and 20 of those were from high school and college football. So,
right. Football is the real contact sport, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And, man, that's an incredible story. This is an incredible story of faith right there. That amazing. I think there's another movie here. Tell me, how do you feel about throwing now? Do you ever throw the baseball now?
I can throw fine.
Yeah.
It is the most amazing thing. I can even do my windup and everything again and not stumble and fall over.
Really? Do you ever put yourself on the radar gun?
At 50, I'm 56 now. At 50, I did this and I threw 92.
Wow.
And I was coaching kids the Under Armour game in Chicago, where they bring all the top kids from around the world in. We work with them for 3 days. Then they play a game at Wrigley Field. And they're goading me, right? Because Clemens goes and then I go. And they're like, come on, man, throw. And I'm like, ah. And, you know, as a guy, when you get challenged,
right,
you got to do something. And so, yeah, I got up there and threw 92 at 50.
I never put myself on a radar gun the entire time we were doing the rookie. And I think I did afterwards or something. And I think it may have been 70-something. But I didn't necessarily – all I wanted to do is I wanted to look like I could. I didn't want to be, like that movie Fear Strikes Out with Tony Perkins, I think, where it's just like – it was so obvious. A guy had never played baseball before in his life. But I just can't imagine. So you think it was maybe the surgeries to begin with that like I said, they took muscle out, and you were just able to hurl that much faster, or you just can't explain it?
Anatomically is not explainable. But here's my deal: as I'm leaving Big Lake to go home for the last time, I'm having real issues with this coach that works there. I'm having issues with my then wife at home, and I'm in between. And I stop my car on the way home and I get out and I'm contemplating, do you go to the tryout? Do you not go to the tryout? What are we going to do here? And so I just get out and I'm listening to a song and I'm like, God, if you want me to do this, you got to show me, because I'm taking a job in Fort Worth, man. This is what I'm doing. And I even went and found my office, and I went and looked at the baseball field and the concession stand with the head coach. And when he found out I signed a minor league contract, he was stunned. He goes, all right, when you get done playing, like I'm playing around, he goes, you come home and we'll get ready for football. And I said, yes, sir. And he kept my job open till the last possible moment. And then I get called up and he comes that first game. And that was cool. But one of the coolest things, I think, for you and me together was on the set. And I had no idea what was going on at the time. You may have known. I had no idea. But they were walking around. They're like, if you could have anybody show up and have dinner with, who would it be to play baseball? And you and I are naming people. And I'm like, yeah, that would be cool. That's awesome. And then we get to New York. And at the 21 Club, they have 21 Hall of Famers come in. And we have dinner with them.
Oh, man, that was something else.
That was an amazing night, man.
Yeah, that really was an amazing night. The premiere of that, wasn't it?
That was incredible.
Yeah. What I was so struck by, and always have been struck by, is your faith that really lies behind it all. And it's and how human you were in that. You've been through crisis in faith, I'm sure. And you... You were a kind of person, you kind of downplayed yourself all the time. But you think it was your faith that got you through all this, that got you, I mean, from the beginning about, with your relationship with your dad and, dreaming about baseball and through the surgeries and through also the failures, all the failures that led to your success. Is it your faith that got you through that? Or is it Jimmy Morris?
Absolutely. It's God. And it's not so much my faith, because we know this better than anybody, Dennis. There are times when we do things and they work out really well. And we're like, I did this and I did that. And this is what I've got going on. And God's sitting there going, what about me? And so you think you're in control of all this stuff and everything going around you. And we're finding out right now, we're at the top of the food chain, but we're getting knocked down by something we can't even see. And so we're not in control of anything. And there are times in my life when I thought, I'm in charge of this and I'm in charge of that. I made stupid decisions and I went through an abusive relationship with my father. And so what do? I married someone who needed fixing just like my dad did. And we were both dysfunctional. We both should not have ever even dated, but we did it because everybody told us we shouldn't. And I've got great kids out of it. Mm-hmm. She got great kids out of it, but we never should have been together. And now I'm married to someone I should be. And I think when I turned back around with my face towards God, I think that's when things started happening. Did things work out? There's miracles, because at 35, you shouldn't be able to throw 100.
Right.
You should be getting out of the game at 35.
Right.
And I'm back in the game. And I think he was just grabbing my attention. He's going, hey, I'm here. Why don't you depend on me? Then in the minors, I want to quit at 35, and things keep happening to keep me there. And so I keep playing, and then that happens. And then you happen. And then the movie happens and Disney and everything else. And it just, I still look back, Dennis, I wake up some days and I'm like, did all this really happen?
Yeah. What did that do to you? Attention and everything? Did it go to your head at all? Looking back?
No, I tried to avoid the limelight. I loved going to the club and watching you play after we had filmed and stuff and going to dinner with you and having fun like that. But I never went, I am tough stuff right now. No, that's not who I am. And I've never been that person.
But I just wanted to hear it out of your mouth, because that's the way I portrayed you. And what I got from you is your humility throughout everything. Cause you knew how fragile life was. And, I think you'd also learn the lesson of you got to be careful about what you pray for, because you just might get it.
Here's the deal about my faith, Dennis, if this makes more sense. From 15 to 18, I lived with my grandparents. Now, my grandmother was our church secretary for 30 years. My grandfather had a menswear store in Brownwood where like Gene Autry would fly in because they were best friends.
My cousin, by the way.
I know. I found that out the other day and I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
But he would come in just to see my grandfather. And while I heard my dad and my mom screaming and yelling at each other, I never, ever heard my grandparents say a word they couldn't take back. And that's just who they were. And they had grace and compassion before grace and compassion were big.
Yeah.
And they taught me that. And I watched them deliver Christmas presents and Thanksgiving dinners for families that couldn't afford it. And I watched them pay a bill for people that couldn't afford it. And so that's where my faith came in. But at 18, when you think you have the world by the tail and you're going, I've got this going on. I watched my grandfather trip in his store one day, and over the next 6 months, from a cane to a walker to a wheelchair, then diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. And the brain works fine and feels everything, but the body doesn't listen to it. And I think that's where I found out where faith is really strong, because the person I love more than anybody in my life, because he made me who I am, was handling this disease with such grace and dignity that I didn't understand that at 18. I'm 56. I still can't comprehend everything he went through. He went from leading people on his shoulders standing up to leading a community from a wheelchair. And he and I are in the kitchen one night, and I'm looking across at him. I'm 18. I've got my whole life in front of me, and he's in a wheelchair. He's hooked up to oxygen. He stooped over. He has clay in his left hand, trying to keep some dexterity in his fingers. And I look at him and I thought of the ugliest thing I could say to my grandfather, because at 18, we're all angry, right? And so at 18, I look at him and the worst thing I could come up with to throw back at him was his faith. And I said, why has God done this to you? You've done nothing but help people your entire life. You've helped people who had no reason to help, and you helped them, and you didn't want anybody thanking you. You just want to do it because that's who you are. And now you've been attacked with this horrible disease. You don't deserve it. Why did God do this to you? And he took in some oxygen and he looked up at me the best he could. And he said, son, I've worked my whole life to get to where I'm going. Where are you headed? And that stunned me, because I thought I would be curled up in the bottom of a closet, unable to come out. the way he handled that disease with such grace and dignity, and it had to be incredibly tough. And I've seen other people, and I've done speeches around where people come up and go, my mother has Parkinson's. And I said, I am so sorry, because that is tough to watch. And she goes, yeah, it's really tough. I have no idea what they're going through because they can't convey it. And I said, you don't want to know.
Wow. That's an amazing story, Jimmy. After all that, you got out of baseball. So how did you become a motivational speaker?
You remember Steve, right?
Yeah.
Steve's my agent. He goes, he looks at me one day, he goes, you're going to be a motivational speaker. And I went, you are smoking crack, dude. I am not speaking to anybody. And I said, 30 people in a classroom makes me incredibly uncomfortable. I'm the most introverted person on the planet. It's not happening. He goes, no, I already forged your name on a contract. You're talking to Major League Soccer front office people in Dallas. I went, ah, oh, you suck. And so I'm writing a book at that time, The Rookie, and the writer, Joel Engel, and I are on our way to Dallas, and Steve keeps calling me. He goes, have you written everything down? I said, yeah, I wrote everything down. He goes, write everything down you want to talk about, and then go talk about it. I said, all right. He goes, you got to talk for an hour. And I said, I can't talk for an hour, dude. And we get there. Dennis, for an hour and 45 minutes, I'm telling my story, and these people do not move a muscle. They don't twinge. There are no phones answered. They don't go to the bathroom. They're just sitting there locked in. And after I get done, I'm like, I think I could do this. So I call Steve. I'm happy, right? I talked for over an hour. And I go, I talked for an hour and 45 minutes. He goes, you can never talk that long. He goes, 15 minutes to an hour. And I'm like, all right. But since then, I've been hooked, because I think people – I've spoken all over the world, and I think people all over the world, we need positive messages, and we need
to hear it. Yeah.
Yeah. We know people, we can overcome a lot. Look at everything you and I have overcome just between the two of us.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I feel like I have the luckiest life ever, but you know, people see, the success or whatever, even those that are close to me sometimes, you know, and there's a lot of failure that goes into success. And it's about really not being afraid of failure, you know, being able to get up and try again. And I think that message is in the Bible throughout. If you look at everybody that God put his hand on, you know, starting with Job, it was a pretty tough road, actually. And it's just being able to get up again and having the faith to do that and trust in God.
Absolutely.
Well, you're just like, I can look at you. This is an audio experience. I'm looking at you on Zoom, and you just, how old are you now?
56.
56. That's right. You're 10 years younger than me. You're in shape, man. You look like you could take the field tomorrow. You sure you don't want to try that rookie thing one more time?
It would be pretty comical right now, I would imagine. I think for a while I could compete, but those guys are at such a level. Holy cow. You just have no idea how talented these people are. Just like the people who have 70 movies under their belt. There is a talent there that we don't see. And like you said it, we're not afraid of failure. And I don't think that's it. I think it's we're not afraid to try. Because you don't know till you know.
That's really true. Yeah. And guys, you're afraid of the answer sometimes, you know, when it comes to that. And so what do you talk about? In your motivational speaking, you basically just tell your story, right?
Yeah. And I do it in a way that is unlike a lot of people, I think, because of my faith. Before I go up and I get ready to talk, and I've talked to 10 people in office building in Chicago, and I've talked to 25,000 people at Busch Stadium. And you talked to me earlier, and you did Albert Pujols. I just remember doing Faith and Family Day with 25,000 people there, looking in the dugout of St. Louis and seeing my daughters hanging on Albert Pujols like he's a jungle gym. And he's just laughing and giggling. And I think that is one point I want to make. It doesn't matter how successful you are, if you keep humble and you keep smiling and realize I got here because of something bigger than me. I think we realize that. It doesn't matter if you've made 70 movies, if you have hit 500 home runs, if you've had a movie made about you. Something bigger has taken place to put you in that situation. And grateful and thoughtful and compassionate. And I think right now this world needs a lot of grace, and we need to treat each other better. And if we had people leading us from Washington that could actually talk to each other without screaming and cursing, I think that would be a big help.
I agree. And, you know, I think what, you know, all the things, the accomplishments and everything, I think you've learned that that is not the measure of success. Measure of success is how you feel about yourself every day, and how, and your family, and how you take care of the things that are really important in life. And because everything else fades. And like you said, it could change in an instant.
Absolutely. So I get back to what you asked me when I go on stage and I speak to people. The one thing I say a little prayer, God, just let the person that you want to hear my message that you want them to hear come through. And if that happens, I'm good. And so I go up on stage with that. And if I'm looking around while I'm talking, and if I catch a person that's kind of looking down or not really grasping, if I get their attention,
yeah,
then that's the rabbit trail I go off. Because if I've got their attention, I got everybody else's.
That's great.
And so it's kind of the same speech, but kind of different too in different areas, because I can go in so many different directions, which you know.
So, hey, are you going out to spring training? Did you go out to spring training before the quarantine or this year?
You know, I was supposed to do a faith day in Tampa at the Tropicana Field, and supposed to be next month. And I do not believe that's going to happen, but they still want me to come out and do some stuff with the stadium once the season starts again. Now, we have no idea what baseball, football, basketball, hockey, track. We don't have any idea what any of that's going to look like. I heard the PGA is going to go, hey, we're going to start next month, but absolutely no fans.
Yeah.
It's going to be a different world.
They might have Major League Baseball, but everybody would play in Arizona, a very contained place.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of that movie Rollerball, or kind of like in the future. And how do you create a fan experience from all that? And the whole city and, you know, team relationship, it's going to be very different. But I think we're Americans, and I think we're going to get back to the life that we had. And I think we're all steeled by this. Who saw this coming? This is a time of life I think all of us are going to remember very well.
Absolutely. I think that God is using this situation to get our attention. It's a kind of a reset.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy, it's been great talking with you, man. And, you know, I might add, you have been there for me since we've made the rookie. I can't tell you how much that means to me. You were at my mom's funeral, but she passed away last year, and it just really meant so much to me to look up and see your face there, bud.
And well, thank you. She was a sweet lady.
So many other times.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate you, because you're always willing to sit and talk. Not everybody does that. Some people think that other people put their pants on, but we know, and we've been through enough. We got to put our own pants on, and we got to get busy. So like you said, this country, we are industrious. And I'm hoping that people are taking this time to reconnect with their marriages and reconnect with their kids and reconnect with those people who are important to them. Like ours, we have 5 kids between Sean and I, and we do Zoom calls once a week. And it's funny because everybody's like contained, and they're like, we want out. And so the Zoom, it allows everybody to get out.
Yeah. Oh, I think they're opening up in Texas. Today's sort of the first day of phase one, right?
Yeah, we went shopping the other day at HEB, which for people who don't know, that's our supermarket in Texas. Yeah. And everybody's staring at us because almost everybody had masks on. I get home and I read this thing and it says $1,000 fine for anybody in public not wearing a mask. And I'm like, oops. So mask it is.
Yeah, they're hard to get used to. Well, they actually, kind of gives me a little bit of anonymity again. So
absolutely.
So it's all good. All right, pal. I hope to see you here real soon, in fact. You know, going to be making the Charlie Pride story. So there's some baseball in that. In fact, we're going to start that next year. So I guess you'll have to be in that one too, right? You have to be an actor this time, though.
That is awesome. My mom loved Charlie Pride. That's going to be cool. I'm glad you get to do that, Dennis.
It's going to be something. All right, pal. Take care down there. Give my love to Shauna, the kids. And you're a great American, dude.
So are you, man. Love and peace.
All right. God bless
Blessings.
You.
Blessings. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Denisseance. Please make sure to rate, review, and of course, subscribe so you can get new episodes delivered straight to your podcast player. Hey, and make sure to tune back in next week.